prepares leaders to become global herbal urban
species
for Christ, not herbal.
I love it.
Previous to that, Randy was the national coordinator for urban projects in the United States for InterVarsity, which placed 2,000 students per year in high crime, high poverty neighborhoods to learn and serve. Randy is the author of two books, Journey to the Center of the City, which talks about making a difference in an urban neighborhood, as well as his most recent book, which is Encounter God in the City, and it's on ramps to personal and community transformation. And both of these books can be found for sale in the IB bookstore downstairs. So I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Randy White.
Well, hey, everybody.
Hi.
Y'all there? Good. It's a tough time of the afternoon, so appreciate your attention and patience. Hey, did they ever figure out what happened with that huge water main break and everything? Like, what caused it? And y'all heard about that, right? You didn't hear? There was a major water main sewer type break over here. It affected a whole bunch of things, and you didn't hear what happened then. You didn't hear what caused it.
No.
That's really good. Okay, I was worried for a minute it was me because, like, I had this huge lunch yesterday, and flushing everything, I just so worried about that. Just good. Okay. Yeah, that didn't get any better the second time around. So.
Third time's the charm.
Okay. Thanks for coming this afternoon, you guys. There are no experts in urban ministry. I am not one of them. So we learn what we learn from what we experience, and that's what you're going to get today. In 1993, my family and I made a decision that now I get the privilege of actually studying in my capacity with Bakke Graduate University. I'm the director of their doctoral program around the world, 300 doctoral students, 100 master's students, studying how to be global urban change agents for Christ. We do it on five continents, all over the world. Cities become our laboratories. And that's how we do it. And so I'll just say now, if you want to talk to us about that, Lauren is here. She'll be here at the end. And we have a booth in the exhibit area. The decision my family and I made in 1993 was to move from the most peaceful and safe neighborhood of Fresno, California, which now the Brookings Report has come out to say is the city in America with the highest levels of concentrated poverty of any large city in the U.S., we moved from the safest neighborhood in that city to the highest crime, highest poverty neighborhood of the city with the highest level of concentrated poverty in the U.S. That neighborhood was called by the police the Devil's Triangle, even though, thankfully, thank Jesus, it's not called that much anymore today, as we've seen some transformation. We bought an old house in the heart of that neighborhood, big old house. We had college students live with us. The house had been abandoned for a number of years and stripped. Then somebody before us had bought it and turned it into a boarding house that was not very reputable and decorated in all sorts of interesting ways after silent film stars that were known for their sexual prowess. And we had pink candy stripe wallpaper and all sorts of very strange things in this old house. Everything was broken in this house. I think God wanted us to understand what our neighbors were struggling with. Housing stock that was dilapidated, that had been rented and not cared for. We had three floods in our first 3 months. I was out in the backyard one time. My wife, Tina, came running. And she said, Randy, hurry. There's a flood in the living room. Or no, she said, there's a waterfall in the living room. Which are words you never want to hear, really. Believe me, you don't want to hear that word. Yeah, I came right into my living room. And there from the ceiling to the floor, there was a waterfall. I had this fleeting thought, like, oh, like I could have a Bible and a notebook and have a little retreat right here in my own. It's like I'm camping or something. Broken plumbing, broken sewer lines. Turns out nothing we had flushed for those first 3 months had actually gone into the sewer, just gone under the house. So it's like the lake from hell down there. Very fertile, though, let me tell you. I grow all sorts of things down there now. Yeah, so we lived there with students and just learned about the neighborhood from the inside. One night, about I guess it must have been 6 months in, there was a shootout around the corner. Guns popped with a most unlethal sound. And young guys with baggy pants hanging down to their knees yelled, "Did you get him? Did you get him?" Bullets ripped past my friend's house and died in a field. And we wondered if there had been human death too. Police came and they kind of brought their own form of chaos, the shouting and the floodlights and the speakers, and it was chaos. But my wife and I, we slept through it. We didn't know it happened until my friend came the next morning. We slept through it because upstairs in our room, two-story house, no air conditioning, Fresno, California in the summertime, 110. We had a single ceiling fan. I think it was 100 years old too, just like the house. It's the kind that goes around about maybe six times in an hour. All the time making out this loud moan. It's like, ah, you know, it's like, okay, we're sweating in bed. Tina and I are just lifting ourselves up, wanting to feel any movement, you know, and the fan is on high. We had the fan on high and it couldn't hear anything. So, but I do remember that next morning. I walked downstairs, sat on my wide front porch, let the gentle Sunday morning breeze nudge me peacefully awake. Walked into the kitchen. Tina was cooking croissants. I love croissants. Saw the steam from the coffee rise in this brilliant morning light that filled the kitchen. I remember that morning. It was a magical morning. Until my friend came and told me the news. I remember thinking the mothers of those kids in that gang fight were having a very different morning. Were they at the morgue? Were they at the jail? Were they at the hospital? Our hands were folded in the thankful bliss of unknowing. Theirs were ringing. We were having a very different morning. And I remember thinking, can I really sleep with that fan on anymore? Because the fact is, I've had the fan on high my whole life. Conveniently deaf to the cries of pain around me. Conveniently deaf. Not knowing is easier, isn't it? And not knowing what's going on in our cities, the things that cry out for justice, that's a hard habit to break. Not knowing is a hard habit to break. I think the starting point for living a life of justice, to making practical steps toward a life of justice, is all about turning off that fan and listening. And to connect ourselves to neighborhoods and people in which shalom has been vandalized. That's the beginning point of a practical justice. And I'm guided by the example of Jesus. Jesus displaced himself in order to connect directly with those he came to serve, in order to do justice. The Bible said he tasted our pain. He relocated to taste it. And since he did taste it, he is committed to establish justice. And you see this from the very first prophecies. Here is my servant, whom I am uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. Bruised reed he will not break, and a calmly dim burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be crushed until he has established justice in the earth. The coastlands wait for his teaching. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. Talk about this at the end, but my definition of justice has everything to do with shalom. Shalom is the most comprehensive, integrative term in the Bible. It means making things the way they should be, in people, between people, and for people. And we'll talk more about that at the end. So Jesus, as we learn from Peterson's great paraphrase of John 1:14, the Word of God became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. Jesus chose to live among us. The scriptures say that he was tested by what he suffered, and therefore he's able to help those who are being tested. Because he's tasted what we're tasting, his solution is sustainable. So helping those who are suffering by means of a detached, unaffected position isn't really a possibility for those who are committed to following Jesus, if we want to do this Jesus way. It's not arm's length. No room for drive-by justice. Charity is short-term and hollow. And I'll make the case today, it isn't even close to being satisfying to do your justice thing or your charity thing and then get on with your normal life. Not even close to being satisfying. Now, Jesus identifies with the displaced themselves as well. You know from the story, the Christmas story that you all just read, you know that he himself was displaced. Immediately after his birth, there was a threat on his life. His neighborhood grew too dangerous. He had to leave, he and his family. What's it like to uproot? I just had a granddaughter 2 days ago, you guys. Elizabeth Joy. Right, my son, Joseph, and his wife, Heidi, live up in Vancouver, BC. And to have Elizabeth Joy and then have to uproot everything because there was a threat on your life, move to a country that you didn't know, and wonder when you could go back. I mean, what does that do to a family? Do you think that family talked about that in Jesus' young years? What was it like when we did that? How hard it was? Do you know that half the refugees on the planet today come from Africa? What do you think? Does Jesus identify with the refugees from Darfur? I think so. How about the refugees from Sudan that are fleeing into Cairo? He knows what it's like to be one of them. My friend Ray Bakke reminds us that a whole village of baby boys died for Jesus before he had a chance to die for them. Right? Herod, the killing of that village, the weeping of Rachel. A whole village of baby boys died for Jesus before he could die for them. You think Jesus understands crack babies and children who suffer because of the decisions of adults? Yeah, I think Jesus understands that because a village of baby boys died for him before he could die for them. Sometime just read the Gospel of Luke and look for this theme, cities and the poor. Jesus spends time among the poor and the outcasts in the cities of his day. The parables or the stories that he told in that book typically involve cities and the marginalized. And the numbers of cities mentioned is remarkable, and his activities in those cities is most often among those mostly in need of justice, the justice of God, and those least likely to get a fair deal from society. He even commands his disciples to do ministry in the city, Luke 14, 21. Now, I have a friend who says there are two verses in the Bible that affirm the virgin birth of Jesus. You all believe that Jesus was born to a virgin, right? It's part of your gospel. You all believe that? My friend says, yeah, he believes that. In fact, he would believe it if there was just one verse in the Bible that talked about the virgin birth of Jesus, right? You with me? You still believe in the virgin birth of Jesus, right? What do we do with the 3,000 verses on poverty and justice in the Bible? Can you quote one of them right now? Because if you can, you're doing better than 90% of Christians in the West who cannot identify poverty and justice as a serious Bible theme. What is wrong with that picture? I spent a year investigating this myself. I got a cheap Bible and I got a yellow highlighter and I highlighted every verse in the Bible that had anything to do with poverty or justice, and I added the theme of the city because I was fascinated by cities and God was doing in cities. And this year I saw this Bible actually came out. The Poverty and Justice Bible. I don't know if you've seen this. Anybody here seen this? Put out by World Vision and Bible Society. They probably have it somewhere in Global Connections down there. But they did the same thing, only they used orange. But there it is, folks. 3,000 verses highlighted already for you. My gosh, what more do you want? I guess we don't like to work that hard for the truth. So, okay, they did it for us. It's an amazing resource. We really are without excuse in so many ways. Jesus' own self-description is one sent with a purpose. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He's sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And from Luke 4, I must proclaim the good news of the kingdom of God to the other cities also, for I was sent for this purpose. Jesus was well aware of the scripture from Micah that we often sing about. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? And so today, when we're talking about practical justice 101, strategies for pursuing justice, when we're talking about that, we're not talking about a list of things to do, things to, you know, to put on your list to pursue justice, next steps. I'm not giving you a five easy steps to justice kind of deal here. We're really talking about larger decisions than that. Because you're all good at locating the information. I mean, before you leave Urbana, some of you will have Googled the topic or, you know, Twittered your friends on what you're learning. Or, I mean, there are all sorts of ways to investigate, find out more, and then communicate that. Humanity has never been in a place where we are so, like, where this stuff is so accessible for those who are interested in getting at it. So y'all are the most intelligent people on the face of the planet. You're privileged and have resources. You got what it takes. So really, we're talking about the larger decisions here. Practical justice starts with making what I think are three really key decisions. And the first decision is to do justice and not just dabble in it. So I want you to say this with me, right? Do, don't dabble. Say it with me. Do, don't dabble. That's what we're talking about today. Doing justice. Now, dabble. Y'all know what the word dabble is, right? Dabble. Like, it means to dip your toe in something. Or it means, you know, he dabbles in the stock market. She dabbles in witchcraft or, I don't know, something like that, you know. Yes, you dabble in, right? So we can't merely acquire a language of justice. There's always a danger of that in evangelical Christianity, that if we start talking a lot about justice, that equals actually doing it. So we got to watch that. We're not looking at acquiring a language. We're not looking at dipping occasionally into chances to seek justice. It's not effective, and again, it's not even remotely satisfying. It's drive-by justice. So I want to share with you what I consider to be Justice 101. These are three strategies, all of them D's. The first D of justice is displacement. You know, has God ever called you to do something for which you felt absolutely unskillful? He's calling me to do something I have no skill for. Maybe it's serving in a leadership position or advocating on a friend's behalf. My family and I knew that God was calling us to the Lowell neighborhood. I'm happy to tell you that full story if you'd like to hear it. I've written about it. But it's enough here to just say that calling didn't have anything to do with the fact that we felt equipped. We didn't. We knew we didn't have the skill set to respond to what he was asking us to do. For seeking justice in Fresno's highest crime, highest poverty neighborhood. We were white, middle class, suburban, overeducated, detached. I mean, what did we have in common with this neighborhood that was primarily Latino, migrant farm workers, Lao and Hmong and Vietnamese refugees, 99.4% of which were poor, living under the federal poverty line? What did we know about that world? I mean, the issues we were faced with were so beyond our skills. I mean, one time we came out of our house in this neighborhood. We were there for a few months, I guess. All dressed up, all four of us. I have two sons, Tina and I. And walked out into our front porch, all dressed up, going to take one of those family pictures under our beautiful California pepper tree in our front yard. And we all froze because there under that tree was a man, all dressed in black, black leather knee boots, about two sizes too big for him, a black cape, a wide brim black hat, and a red sash around his neck. You got the picture? Yeah, so Zorro is standing in my front yard. Okay. And he's talking to my tree. Okay, yeah, so you don't see this every day. So we kind of froze there. And he wasn't just talking with my tree. He was having an outright argument with my tree. I mean, It's a lowly little California pepper tree. I don't know what I could have done or said to him, but he was having an argument with my tree, okay? And we thought it was over. He turned to leave, and then he had an afterthought. And he turned again to continue the argument with my tree, speaking Mixtec Indian and Spanish and English, and we heard the English curse words, so we kind of figured the tenor of the discussion. So later we learned this man's name was Raymond. He was mentally ill, living in a board and care unit down the street, and addicted and an alcoholic. What did I know about his world? 3 o'clock one morning, he knocked on my door, and I came down in my pajamas. I opened the door and I said, Raymond, what? He said, Father, they tried to mug me. Raymond always called me Father. I tried so many times to say, I'm not a priest, Raymond. You don't have to call me Father. That's the only category he had for a man who was religious or followed Jesus or something. He had been attacked by the gang that lived around the corner. There were three gangs in our neighborhood, the Bulldogs and two Asian gangs. We brought him in, called the police, waited. They didn't come. So after 15 minutes or so, went out in the front porch, kind of looked around. Nobody was there, so we thought, we'll flag them down when they come. Waited there for another 15 minutes. Police didn't come. So okay, let's go out to the curb. We'll see them, and we'll stand under the light. Got out to the curb, waited 15 minutes more, still didn't come. Sat down on the curb. It's 4 something in the morning. I'm thinking, my gosh, the gang guys are still up, and they're still around the corner. And after a few more minutes, I started rocking. Like, this is stupid, Randy. What are you doing out here? What game are you? What are you pretending? What do you have to offer this guy? He's addicted. He's mentally ill. He thinks you're a priest. How absurd is this? You've got Zorro and the pajama priest sitting with water going under their legs at 4:30 in the morning. Doing justice, Randy. I rolled my eyes. I just about got up. And at that second, Raymond, like a child, leans into me. And he says, Father, would you pray for me? That was the first complete sentence I'd heard from him in a long time. He was hardly ever lucid, hardly ever sober. So I thought, well, yeah, okay, I can do that. I can do that. I know how to do that. So yeah, we prayed. A couple of weeks later, Raymond comes by and he says, you have a Bible, Father? I'd like one. And I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah. I mean, priests have Bibles, right? I got Bibles. Yeah, I can do that. I didn't have to know the whole picture. God didn't call me to have the full skill set or specialize in mental illness to help him have an on-ramp to something. He required me to be there. I had to be displaced in order to be in that first expression of justice that God wanted our lives to include. I had to be displaced. Learning to do justice was to displace ourselves enough to gain contact and experience with those who are suffering from the forces that were shaking the neighborhood. And that displacement led to some practical strategies as well. But this displacement is what John Perkins talks about when he talks about relocation, which is a strategy that God will call some in this room to. Not all, but some. Living a life of justice requires that we allow some of those forces to touch our lives. We won't understand those forces and we won't care about them unless we're somehow impacted by them as well. So we met Raphael, who was 7 years old when we met him. He was kicking my screen on my front porch. I came to the door and I said, hey, what's your name? Raphael! Raphael, don't kick my front porch, okay? I mean my screen. Okay, give me some candy. No. So, okay, bye. 15 minutes later, Raphael's back kicking the screen on my front porch again, and I say, hey, please don't kick the screen on my front porch, okay? Okay. 15 minutes later, he's back with 7 of his friends, running up on the front porch, kicking my screen, jumping off the side, running around to the front, coming up to the front porch, kicking my screen, jumping off the side, running around the front, like a herd of elephants, right? What do you do? Clearly, my first approach had not worked. So you invite him in, and you start a tutoring program, which lasts 15 years every Wednesday afternoon in my living room. where 20 college students mentor and tutor kids from the neighborhood. That really became an important strategy for Raphael, because one time he was sitting next to me at my computer at home, and he's in the second grade at the time, I guess he's 9 or so. I said, "Hey, Raphael, what's the spell? C-A-T." And he said, "I don't know." I said, "Really? Hey, all right, how about D-O-G? What's that spell?" "I don't know." So I called his teacher and said, "What's the deal? Is he dyslexic? Because that's like my only category for a kid who's 9 who can't read cat or dog." She said, "No, he's not dyslexic. He's disgusted with himself and with his family. He won't try anymore." And we see him out at 11:30 at night, highest crime neighborhood of the city. I said, "What do I do?" She said, "Just read. Just read to him." Which we did for a year. And at the end of the year, he sat us down in the aisle of Barnes & Noble and read us an entire book on par for his level in the space of 1 year. Seeking justice was simply to read to Raphael, because his school was unable to spend that kind of time with him, which is just what he needed, in addition to the ability to sit next to somebody whenever he wanted to, or kick somebody's screen and feel included. Our displacement meant some hard things. A young woman was shot and came bleeding to our door. She was a prostitute. My wife Tina was frozen in fear. That led to sending interns to Evangel Home, which is a place the prostitutes go to put their lives back together now. Our displacement meant that we experienced the same inconveniences as our neighbors. An entire row of lights went out on our street in the highest crime neighborhood. You want light. Believe me, you want light. Called the city after a day and a half and said, "Hey, you know, all the lights on our street went out. What's going on?" And they hemmed and hawed and said, "Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Oh, yes, we're aware of that. Yes, we're working with that, Mr. White." And that's their way of saying, "Huh, there's a problem?" You know, 4 days later, still no lights. Called back and they said, "Oh, you're going to get a kick out of this, Mr. White. We found out there's a homeless guy, and he's discovered that if he takes the faceplates off of the lamppost, that he can pull up the copper wire, the copper ground wire, and he balls it up and takes it into the recycler. Copper fetches a really good price. And ingenious, huh? We call him the copper wire bandit." And I said, "Yeah, that's really ingenious. Hey, how about welding those faceplates so that he can't do that anymore? And let's fix that light, okay?" "Well, we don't want to do that until we catch him." Now, if that had happened in, think of the nicest neighborhood in your city. Got it in your head? If that had happened in that neighborhood, how many days do you think would have gone by? How many days do you think went by in my neighborhood? A month? 4 months without light in the highest crime neighborhood of the city. They could do that because they know they're not going to get protests from my neighbors. My neighbors are afraid to call City Hall. They don't know the right department. And even when they do call, they get the runaround because they have accents. What's justice right there? Justice says those of us who do have power, who do have leverage, who do understand the neighborhood, we come together and we call the city. And we get those lights turned back on before they catch the guy. We come up with a different strategy to make sure he doesn't keep doing it. And that's the only way the lights came back on. You know, scripture started jumping out at us, like from Isaiah 61. "You will become known as the repairer of streets in which to live." Whoa! Cool! Oh, I didn't know the Bible talked about streets and stuff like that. You know, in my neighborhood, we now have lights on every alley in our neighborhood because of our little coalition of people that moved in with us. No other neighborhood in the city has lights on their alley, for crying out loud. We got lights on our alley now. Justice goes overboard sometimes. Right? Abundant justice. Our displacement also meant chances for our hypocrisy to be exposed. So there was a time early in our time there where we had a group of students in my living room This is when I worked for InterVarsity, and they were going to be the tutors in the Wise Old Owl tutoring program that we were planting in the neighborhood. And we named it Wise Old Owl because that's the only emblem I had on my computer that looked like education. It was a little owl with a mortarboard, you know, the graduation cap and everything. So we called it Wise Old Owl. And we're studying Isaiah 58, that classic passage. True fasting is to share your food with the hungry, welcome the poor stranger into your midst. In essence, true relationship with God equals compassionate action on behalf of the poor. That's what Isaiah 58 is all about. Right? That's true justice. And there's a knock on my door. Inwardly, I roll my eyes. Not now. Come on, I'm teaching. I say, hold on, you guys. I go to the door. I open it up, and there's this guy looking like something out of like a zombie movie or just absolutely filthy. Smells, I can smell the alcohol in his breath, and he hands me a note, and the note says, "Hi, my car ran out of gas 3 blocks up the road, and I just need $3 for gas." And so, okay, all right. This is like one in a long line of requests, just like this, that I've had, okay? You know, somebody's car breaks down, they need money for gas. And early on, you know, I actually wondered, like, what is it about my street that's so hard on cars? This line of men who come by and say their car is broken down. Like, this is like real naivete, okay? But I'd seen this guy in the neighborhood, seen him talking. I knew he was not deaf. The note said, "Hi, I'm deaf, and my car broke down." This is like a combination of reasons. I need your help. It happened so often, I felt like asking, "Show me your keys. Just show me your keys." Right? But I'd seen this guy before, and I knew that this was a con, and I wasn't going to have it. So I handed the note back to him, shut the door to his bewildered face, and continued back to my study where we continued to study compassionate action on behalf of the poor. Except my students weren't having any of that. They wanted to study me and my response to this guy. And what could I have done differently about this had I been more Jesus-like? Which I thought was terrible for my credibility as a Bible study leader. But it turns out it was one of the most fruitful, productive things that had happened in that study and in my life. There are better ways to respond to needs when we see it. Not just charity, but real justice ways. Experiences like that led us to help begin organizations in our neighborhood and facilitate pathways for men just like the one that showed up on my door so that there's a better response. Displacement means entering into a context where you're no longer insulated from the same forces operating in your neighborhood. It's the first step toward leading a life of justice. I have a friend who was a pastor, pastoring in a slum community in Mexico City. He was middle class, educated, very charming man. He spoke at the Last Urbana. His name is Saul Cruz. Good friend. He was trying to plant this church in this slum community. They just weren't having it. They didn't trust him. He was in a different social class than they. They were really the abject poor. One time in the middle of a Sunday morning service with a few people gathered at church, the men of the community ran up the street and said, "Pastor Cruz, you need to come. The sewer has broken." The side of a mountain, there was a massive sewer line that had a joint in it, and the joint had become dislodged, emptying out the sewage right into this side of the hill, which became a cavern, then a cavernous cave, and had sent everything down the side of the hill. It overrun the village. So Saul ran with the other men, and all night they worked to build a kind of a rampart up to this pipe that was hanging overhead, and so that they could re-raise that pipe to meet it and then bind the joint until the city would come out and fix it. And the city didn't respond at all to any of their requests, even though this is a bona fide emergency. Worked all night. In the morning, they emerged from the cave, literally covered in human excrement. It was raining, and the rain began to wash the crap off of them. And then the women of the village came and began to wash their bodies. Saul says, "I was so glad that it was raining, because then they couldn't see my tears." Everything changed. The whole community joined his church. Everything changed. It takes you being covered in crap. It takes you being covered in the smell of human suffering for people to trust. huge principle in seeking justice. Will you let yourself be touched by the things that are touching those who do not receive justice in our country? Whether it's criminal justice, the justice of the right application of jurisprudence, whether it's justice in housing, whether it's justice in health care, will you let yourself be touched by the things that are affecting the lives of those who do not have justice? So what are some possible practical strategies then for displacement? Well, what about intentional relocation to a dorm or perhaps eventually a neighborhood that it's intimidating for you or outside of your comfort zone? It doesn't have to be to a neighborhood like mine. It could be simply to a neighborhood that is so different than your own. What about attending meetings of groups on campus that you disagree with theologically in order to understand them or even accomplish something together? What about attending a church that's different from you in terms of ethnicity or social class or their style of worship? That's a really huge displacement. What about attending a civic association meeting where you're the only non-resident, but yet nevertheless committing yourself to help them achieve their goal for their community? Now, here's the thing. Maybe some of you already come from a neighborhood like the one I've been describing. Maybe you're already touched by all these things. Maybe you've experienced the kind of marginalization that we've been talking about in terms of my neighbors. Maybe your situation was your family was routinely marginalized. Perhaps your decision isn't so much about relocation or displacement. Maybe, as John Perkins says, your decision is to remain. Because one of the number one problems across the world today is something we call brain drain, where the brightest and best move up and out and don't stay to help their communities transform. And I understand the up and out phenomenon. It's not a bad thing for people to get up and out. And they want shalom. That's why they're going. But God does call some to remain. And just like not all of you will be called to relocate to a neighborhood like mine, not all of you will be called to remain in one if that's where you grew up. But God calls both to relocate and remain. So I guess the next thing to do is to ask a fan question. In what comfort zone do I need to be displaced in order to learn about the justice God wants to bring to my city or to my campus? Would you do this? Would you just take a few seconds, and if you've got a notebook, jot something down. And it could be the first thought that comes to your head. It won't necessarily be the best thought, but jot something down. What comfort zone do I need to be displaced in order to learn about the justice God wants to bring to my city or campus? Because I think it's important for you guys to vocalize these things, I'm going to give you 1 minute, 30 seconds each. I want you to turn to your neighbor. Just say your name, what city you're from. Don't go any further than that. And then say, here's what I'm thinking. I don't know, but here's what I'm thinking. And do that in 30 seconds. And then I'm going to say switch. And then the other person do it for 30 seconds. I just want you to vocalize it to somebody. Okay? Tell them what you're thinking. All right. I know that you didn't have enough time. I know. But I know that this is the beginning of a conversation. I know you didn't have enough time, and that's frustrating. Keep it going. You'll be able to continue that conversation if you'd like, but it's more important that you actually said something. And I also know that some of you didn't, like, have anything to say, and that's okay, too. I hate being told to think on the spot and come up with an answer, so I'm sorry I'm making you do it because I don't like it, but I know how important it is. It's important to be asked, even if you don't know, and I encourage you to then jot some things down after the session. What did you say? Don't let that escape from your grip. Now, we've said displacement, therefore, is the first strategy. The second strategy is dismantle. What is God calling you to dismantle? Could it be unhealthy ways of spending money or time? Could it be addictions that control your world? Could it be stereotypes that you have? I'll never forget, there was this one young guy, 17 years old, named Alejandro. Alejandro was in a gang, he's in the Bulldogs gang. Very intimidating looking guy. I met him when he was 17. I don't know why, but we got into this thing where we'd go out to pie for every week. We'd go to Denny's and work our way through their pie menu, you know? Except when we got to Key Lime. He just would not go to Key Lime. He refused. But we'd come back from pie, and he'd sit in my living room. And it's so weird. Alejandro was a stocky-looking kid, very intimidating, slicked back hair, ponytail on the back, shaved sides of his head, baggy pants, one foot in the gang, kind of one foot in a ministry. And he'd sit in my living room, and he'd read. And I noticed this kid liked history. He's named Alejandro. I told him a lot about Alexander the Great, you know, his namesake. And one time, he sat there for 2 hours in my living room and read National Geographic. Now, I don't read National Geographic. I look at the pictures in National Geographic. But Alejandro read National Geographic. Okay, now I tell you guys, this was 1997. Those of you who know anything about history know that in 1997, Hong Kong was given back to China by the British, who had been the owners of Hong Kong as their colony for 100 years, right? Significant year. Now that's amazing that a capitalist society was giving, you know, a nation back to a communist. There was this big turnover. Alejandro, after 2 hours, he looks up at me and he says, "So, Pastor Randy, what do you think will happen when Hong Kong reverts to China?" Now, this is a 17-year-old gang member from my neighborhood asking me about geopolitical movements on the other side of the world. My mouth hit the floor. And in that instant, in that little nanosecond, the Holy Spirit slapped me upside the head and said, "What, that surprises you, Randy? Why can't a 17-year-old gang member think about these issues like an intelligent person? Is there something preventing him from doing that? Could it be his social class in your mind? Could it be his race in your mind?" Yeah, God had to dismantle my stereotypes. Could be Cece in my neighborhood. I first met Cece. She's 55 years old. She wore pink hot pants. She wore biker gloves with the knuckles cut off. She wore wore a choker with the spikes coming out. She wore a bandana. She wore a halter top or a tank top that was like way too small for her. All right, I decided within the first 15 minutes that I was not going to have anything in common with this woman, nor could I talk with her very long. She probably didn't have anything to say that would interest me, and she wouldn't appreciate me. And in fact, whenever she did talk with me, she put on the thick Chicana accent, even though I heard her talking without a Chicana accent to other people. Well, when I met Cece, it just shows you how wrong you can be about most things. At least how wrong I can be. Cece is the Mother Teresa of my neighborhood. She's on every civic committee. She's the one who cooks for the children on her block. She's the one who confronts the police about the shooting that happened on her block. She's the one that put the new roof on the YWCA. She's the one that orchestrates the health fair at the local school. She was everything that my mind wouldn't let her be. God had to dismantle some things in my life, and he was more than willing to use the people of the neighborhood to do that. Or maybe he had to dismantle my naivete, you know, welcoming the homeless person in to use my office. Until I happened to walk by my office one time and hear him completing the drug deal, that apparently my office with InterVarsity at the time had been the center of the drug trade in the neighborhood. That was a hard one to explain to my supervisors at the time. A little naivete. Or, you know, the guys in the median will work for food. To see behind that, to know what's going on there, there was a lot of dismantling going on. I began to understand my own privileges and how they work for my advantage and how people in my neighborhood didn't have access to those same privileges. All of that was God dismantling my naivete. And God dismantled our fear, too. Some of it blown out of proportion, but some of it real. One night, I got a call from our neighbor behind our house. She said, Randy, your flower pots are walking down the street. I thought, geez. Okay, these flower pots are large, beautiful flower pots. They're on our front porch, two of them. And somebody tried to steal them the year before, so we put cement in the bottom of them, hoping to make them heavier and harder to carry off. But these four big gang guys had no problem with the weight, and apparently they had stolen our big, beautiful flower pots that were filled with these geraniums, these pink, flowing geraniums. They flowed over the edge. They were spectacular. We'd used, you know, Miracle-Gro on them and had been disciplined about it, you know, and it was hard to hear that. But I'm thinking, I really don't want to go after gang guys to retrieve my geraniums. And she says, so I called the police, and they're probably going to call you. And I said, oh, geez, okay. First of all, I'm thinking, okay, come on, maybe I should just let the guys have them. I mean, a little pink in their lives. Maybe that will do them some good, right? My sons are right there, though, and they're saying, come on, Dad, we've got to do something. Can't let this stuff happen. Can't let it stand. You have to push back. So while we're talking, then the police call. And they said, Mr. White, just want to clarify what we're looking for here. I said, well, they're geraniums, they're you know, they're pink. And then they said, well, what's a geranium? It's a vined flower. It pours over the edge in this spectacular array and splay of color. And so excited about my geraniums, you know. And they said, we think we have them here. Can you come take a look? I said, let me get this clear. First of all, are you new here? You want to have me come stand in front of the gang house? Well, you know, we can't move ahead with this unless you identify that these are your geraniums. Okay, so my son and I walk down, and in the street, on the curb, are five guys handcuffed. A police cruiser with its lights on going this way. A police cruiser with its lights on going this way. And there in the middle, its vines trembling in the light and the night air, is my pink geranium. I felt so stupid. I said, yep, that's my geranium, all right. You know. So I went back, got everybody to bed, slept downstairs that night because I knew there would be retaliation. I was filled with fear. For me and for my family, etc. And I prayed a little-known prayer of St. Francis of Assisi that night. The prayer says, "All highest, glorious God, shine your light into the darkness of my heart. Give me right faith, firm hope, perfect charity, and profound humility. With wisdom of perception, O Lord, so that I may do what is truly your holy will." Prayer of St. Francis. And my fear absolutely melted away. The next day, we were compelled to go get the police report, and we read about the guys they had apprehended that night, and the stories, my gosh, the unbelievable stories of chaos in their lives. One young man, 17 years old, had been rejected by his mother, and she wouldn't take him back because of the pain he had caused her. And so he'd gone to live with a guy who's on parole, and we just see this bubbling cauldron of chaos. And God gave us hearts for these men, these young men. We tried to meet them, but within 3 weeks they'd been evicted, and they were gone. God dismantled our fear, though, and dismantling things is a justice action on the part of God. It's something we have to cooperate with and set the stage for in our lives. So here's another fan question. What needs to be dismantled in your life in order for you to start living a lifestyle of justice? What needs to be dismantled? Any of those things we talked about true for you? Let me just give you 30 seconds. This time I won't have you share, but do write something down. I know you're not done, but you've got something started and you can continue writing. Later today. The third practical strategy we need is to discover. It's a discovery process. And the first is the call for justice in the Bible. I mean, you guys have access to all the beautiful Bible studies and commentaries that you need. No time in history has there ever been more resource on this subject. Evangelicals in the last 20 years have finally caught on. There shouldn't ever have been a divorce between evangelism and social action. Sojourners and other communities have returned those two things together. God, our commitment to Jesus, to follow him personally, individually, and our horizontal commitment to others. Right? Those things are married. Let no one tear them asunder. They belong together. So you've got all sorts of resources. You've got Scott Bessnecker's new book, How to Inherit the Earth. Just came out hot off the press. You've got Kevin Blue's book, Practical Justice. Kevin taught on the subject at the last Urbana. You've got this fabulous new book just hot off the press, The Social Justice Handbook, Small Steps for a Better World. She goes through so many issues of justice. Folks, we're without excuse. We've got access to the issues, the resources, creative thinking, great models to look at. That's not the problem. The problem is, have we taken the journey yet to displace ourselves or be displaced, to dismantle those things in our lives that are preventing us from the pursuit of justice, and we have not placed ourselves on the journey of discovery. So perhaps we should discover the call for justice in the Bible. Perhaps we should discover the growth that comes from risk or pain. When our son Jameson was in sixth grade at Lowell School, which had the worst record in Fresno Unified, Tina and I would go to bed at night, look at each other and say, "We're bad parents. Look what we're doing." What's going to happen in Jameson's life if he doesn't get the kind of education that other privileged kids get to have because of our decision? That was made even worse when one afternoon Jameson's life was threatened by a gang. The school found out and protected him. We came and got him. He was pretty shaken by it. Went home, sat on the edge of his bed, and we read Psalm 90 together about being safe in the shelter, the shadow of the Most High, safe under his wings. He's a strong tower. We can run into him. I said, "Jamie, was that true for you today? Did that happen? Was God there at your side today?" He thought about it, and he said, "Well, Dad, I guess so, because I didn't get hurt, and the school found out about it. The police went to the gang guy's house and confronted him, and he was there." Now, Jameson is, you know, in his 20s now, and he's graduated from college, he's married, works for Youth for Christ, but for his college entrance essay at 18 years old, he actually wrote about that time when he was 12 years old and he learned that God was there for him. Now, the methodology of learning that lesson is not something any parent wants to prescribe, right? But God brought fruit from that painful experience. The growth that comes from risk or pain is unbelievable, permanent, beautiful growth that in the end was worth the pain. That's the hope that we're given as followers of Jesus. Perhaps it's a journey of discovery of the gifts we didn't know existed. My wife Tina is an introvert. Now that some of the 30 people who have joined us in our neighborhood, who have become part of our community seeking the shalom of the devil's triangle, many of the women in that group of people are flaming extroverts. They love starting ministries. They love being with kids. They love being in situations of risk. Tina is this quiet listener, a good friend. And she wanted to know, does the neighborhood need what I have? Or does it need another flaming extrovert? When I take a walk in my neighborhood and I hear women crying at dusk, their tears pouring out the window, do you think they need Tina? Yeah. Several women in the neighborhood have found Tina to be an incredible listener and a good friend. So discover the gifts that you didn't know existed. Amanda, my other friend, thought she was going to go into ministry, right? We think that's vocational ministry, right? When someone goes into ministry. Except the Lord wanted her to work for a congressman in Sacramento, where she got to actually work on human trafficking legislation. She didn't know that she was wired for that kind of work, but she turned out she loved it. She found a gift that she didn't know that she had. Perhaps we're called to discover new perspectives on the urban poor. The fact that there's beauty in the city. The gal who makes tamales and sells them in my neighborhood, she puts them in a shopping cart, she pushes them down the alley, except that she also sells silk flowers, these magenta-colored silk flowers, which she puts in the cage, right? It looks like a Rose Bowl float going down my alley. I mean, it's the most beautiful thing. Or there's Juan Gonzalez. Juan, this muscular, really well-built guy, gang tats all over his body, sitting in my living room, caring for his two daughters. In an alley, he'd be really intimidating. In my living room, he exercises more patience with his two daughters than I've ever had with my sons. That's beautiful. My idea has been changed. That's a justice issue. Our ideas are changed when our stereotypes are confronted. Maybe it's about discovering God's plan for our shalom. It has to do with very physical things. Remember we talked about being called the repairer of streets? This little community that's grown in my neighborhood, we've repaved the roads in my neighborhood now. As I mentioned, we've got streetlights on our alleys now. We've had buildings torn down that have been crack houses for generations. We have a park in the neighborhood now. We have one of our students graduated, went through one of our urban projects. She's starting a mobile grocery unit to bring groceries to the neighborhood because the poor often have to travel far without transportation or else buy at the corner store, which is really expensive. This little community has formed a nucleus over the last 15 years that's found ways to pursue justice, very practically, but only because they were there enough to figure out what the issues are from the inside. The urban project system that Scott Besnecker and Josh Harper lead here in the U.S. with InterVarsity places something like 2,000 students a year in high crime, high poverty neighborhoods. A couple years ago, they placed some students in the Bowery Mission, a 100-year-old mission in New York City. These are Columbia students who were business majors, and they thought they'd be ladling soup in this homeless outreach. Well, guess what? The Bowery found out that they were Columbia, business majors, and they put them on writing a business plan for expanding the Bowery Mission to Coney Island, because that's where the poor were moving. College students expanded the capacity of a 100-year-old mission organization, and now it's serving the homeless in Coney Island. That's a form of leveraging the privilege and the knowledge that you have for God's shalom kingdom, God's kingdom of justice. Or Kevin Blue will tell you about a story in Los Angeles where there's a liquor store selling to underage, to minors constantly, and the police aren't doing anything about it. So they absolutely raised hell, or raised heaven, really, depending on how you look at it, and pestered City Hall till they closed the place down, and now it's a grocery store serving the neighborhood. Because this group of people knew how to call City Hall. Leveraging the privileges that you do have is a significant justice strategy that's very practical. And we've got Bible clubs and tutoring programs, et cetera, et cetera. My role with Bakke Graduate University is to study systems that work like this and then be able to train the next generation of global transformational leaders. That's kind of my privilege, what I get to do. Or we discover our need for community. So every week we gather as a community and we pray for our neighborhood and we eat together, and sometimes we prayer walk in our neighborhood. Sometimes we weep together. Remember, one of the two times that Jesus wept was for his city. Sometimes we weep together. Or sometimes we discover our role as advocates. One of our students was cut one time by a gang member. We brought the police in, but they didn't believe our student. They accused her of lying. We had to bring the police chief in and advocate on her behalf. The officer that submitted the report reprimanded. Sometimes you have to advocate. These are justice responses. So here's another fan question then. What might God want me to discover at Urbana 09 or back in my city that could lead to a lifestyle of doing justice and seeking shalom? This time, just write the question down. I want you to spend more time on that than you're going to have in our session here together. So we've said that the three D's of doing justice, not just dabbling in justice, the three D's are displacement, dismantling, and discovery, and that these lead to practical strategies. But practical justice isn't just a list of to-dos, it's a way of being. Doing justice means seeking shalom. And shalom means making things be the way they ought to be. Mennonite scholar Perry Yoder studied every single use of the word shalom in the Bible. Discovered that shalom is the single most integrative concept in the scriptures. It's so hard to get your arms around the definition because it means at least five different things. We translate it as peace, as in Jeremiah 29, seek the peace of the city to which I've sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its peace you will find your peace. Well, all those words peace are the word shalom. But it means well-being as well. It means prosperity. It means justice. Yoder coined a term. He called it right justice. It's a term we actually don't have. But that's how large a category it is. But he took a look at every use of the word shalom, and he found that each time that word is used, it falls into one of three categories. Either shalom is talking about making things the way they should be for people. In other words, that they ought to have enough in their lives, they ought to have shelter, they ought to have food, they have security, well-being, love. Or shalom talks about the way things ought to be in people. In other words, they ought to be morally upright and speak the truth and not lie. Or that shalom means making things right between people. In other words, that there's resolution of conflict, there's reconciliation. It means righteousness combined with justice. Another scholar, Nicholas Woltersdorf, says shalom is the well-being and flourishing of all that God has created. Flourishing is a beautiful word, isn't it? I love that word. Flourishing. That describes what I wanted to happen in Alejandro's life, in Raphael's life, in Stephanie Kaufman's life, the woman that was shot, came bleeding to our door. It involves reconciliation and enjoyment with God, with others, with oneself, and with the physical environment. So I guess what I've tried to say is, in all of these things, we've said there are very practical steps. We've described some of those things, but what's more important than having a list is having made a decision to do justice, not merely dabble in it, to dismantle some things, to discover some new things, to be displaced in order to understand even what the issues are, and that can happen at many levels. And let me tell you, I just don't think it's complex. It is hard, but it's not complex. It's as simple as what happened one afternoon at a little soccer game at one of our tutoring programs. A beautiful, bright day under a canopy of trees at one of my neighbor's house. A group of about 20 kids from the neighborhood, mostly Latino, mostly Mexican, were playing soccer before our tutoring program. And I was watching them. There were about, 12 or 13 boys and one girl. And the girl was beating the boys. She was dribbling around them. She scored the only goal that I saw while I was there. Her black hair flying behind her, her school jumper wiggling all over the place. She was really a sight to behold. She was kicking their butts. I came up to her afterwards and I introduced myself to her. I said, "Hi, I'm Pastor Andy. What's your name?" And she just looked at me. And I said the same thing in Spanish, and she still didn't respond. So pretty soon, this other little girl comes up. Turns out she was her cousin, Crystal. She says, she's not deaf. I mean, she's not Spanish speaking. She's deaf. She brushed her hair back from behind her ear, and sure enough, there was a little misshapen ear and a hearing aid. And so we gathered them into the tutoring room, and Kimberly, the little girl's name, she stood by the door, watched everybody else get into their chairs, and the boys were over there playing on the computer, and I watched Kimberly. She was watching them. She wanted to beat them at that computer game, too, I could tell. But she would never sit down, never enter in, and this happened for weeks. Crystal and I would sit down in my little black Naugahyde chair and read, and Kimberly'd be at the door. I've watched them go home. I watched them cross the street. Watched them get screamed at by the man who lived in that house. Watched them dissolve in tears and in fear. And I've known too many 7 to 13-year-old girls who simply end up pregnant in my neighborhood. And I know what the neighborhood is trying to do in their lives. It's a neighborhood of shadow for them. One afternoon, I'm sitting in this chair, and I see this shape start walking over to me, and my heart leaps. Kimberly takes up place right to my left here, close to my mouth. Crystal's behind me on this shoulder, and we're reading, and we're laughing. I'm reading a page. Crystal's reading a page. Kimberly takes up place right here, and she starts getting into the story, too. Pretty soon, I feel these little fingers on my shoulder, and they're Crystal's, and she's trailing her fingers down the seam of my blue denim shirt that I'm wearing that day, right? And absentmindedly trailing them back up. And I glance back there, and she doesn't know what she's doing. She's into the book. She's reading. She's laughing. Pretty soon, on my left arm, another set of fingers, and it's Kimberly, and she's got the hair on my arm, and she's lifting it up, twirling it around, combing it down in rows. First I got to get an arm haircut. I didn't realize it was that long. And she's totally like into the book too. She doesn't know what she's doing. And I tell you, I don't know what happened, but in that moment there was this cone of what I can only describe to you as the shalom of God descended on that place, where suddenly, in a neighborhood of shadow, there was the absence of shadow, there was the absence of fear, and justice was being done, even if for a moment, in the lives of two little girls who felt safe enough to read and laugh with a hairy-armed pastor in this place called Wise Old Owl Reading Club. I saw an article that Kimberly wrote for this newspaper that got published in our general newspaper down the road, where she was advocating on behalf of a people group. It was about 10 years after that incident. Justice is hard, but sometimes it can be as simple as creating a safe place. And that has become, for us, a beginning point to learn about the larger, more complex issues that we have to get going on. That's been our journey off point. Brothers and sisters, shalom has been vandalized. All is not well. Things are not as they're supposed to be. God requires his people to do justice and not just dabble in it. This means we need to turn off the fans in our lives, anything that would drown out the cries of pain around us. That's the first step in adopting a lifestyle of justice. And from there, we can discover shalom, making efforts in our own city and on our campuses, and we can attach ourselves to them. And there are all sorts of resources in the world to help you do it. And I know you will. We have about 20, 25 minutes for questions. Before we do our questions, I want just to tell you again that if you are feeling like you'd like to get a little more deeply into this, like a lot more deeply into this, and you're at a place where you want to do it more formally, which might include graduate level study, either at the master's or the doctoral level, I'm so proud of what our school is doing around the world with about 300 doctoral students and about 100 master's level students who are becoming global urban change agents for Christ. We do it on 5 continents. This is a chance to use cities as laboratories, and I invite you to come talk to us. Lauren will be over there afterwards if you want to get more information about Bakke Graduate University. And if we have time at the end, maybe I'll show you a little 4-minute video that shows you one of our classes that we did. That's kind of fun. So, what kinds of questions came up for you? We can spend some time together dwelling on them. We do have mics, so you want to hand one down here? Remember, there are no experts in urban ministry. That's what I started with, right?
My question is, I'm involved in a varsity group at Binghamton University. It's 3 hours north of New York City. And one of the reasons people often choose it is because it's a state university. Economically, it makes a lot of sense. So working with intervarsity students, I noticed that, first of all, a lot of people were a lot of the same socioeconomic status. We often, were required by the university to purchase a meal plan. Most of us are living on dorms on campus because we don't have cars because we're from New York City. So we are kind of put in this place where we have unlimited electricity, unlimited water. But we have a choice of picking whatever food we want, whenever we want it. How, as college students, given that I still have time left before I graduate. How can we let that just affect us, not just in this kind of 9-to-5 way of work, or like a short-term thing, but actually letting the problems affect us that we want to alleviate?
Yeah. A lot of your world is determined for you, is what you're saying. And the challenge to all of us, some of us have that same situation provided by our jobs. Those of us who are called to marketplace ministry are in very similar situations. You hang out with a similar class of people, similar education levels. Your day is dictated. So college actually isn't that different from the rest of your life if you pursue a marketplace approach to your faith and get a so-called secular form of work. So what you're describing, and I know it's hard to believe for many of you who are in college, but you will never have more time on your hands than you do right now. It just absolutely gets worse. So if you can't figure it out how to do it now, then you're really going to have a problem if you get into the workforce and so much more of your life is dictated for you as well. So having said that, you then have to examine where are the holes? Where are the holes and where are the ways the requirements of your life actually merge with the areas of shalom God wants you to explore. So, is there a requirement in your major to do an internship somewhere? Does your campus know about intern options that are not on necessarily their list, but that could satisfy a requirement that you could suggest? Perhaps it's a nonprofit or an NGO that's working in or near where you are that your campus didn't know about, that you could get on their approved list that then you could go work for as part of your campus assignment. Where does the life you have now merge with this shalom life God wants to get you on board with? And doing that discipline is something that will serve you the rest of your life, whether it's the campus dictating your schedule or some employer dictating your schedule. So that'd be one thing. Find out where those touch points are, where the dual purposes of your student life and your shalom life, so we'll just call it that, can overlap. And then I'd say there are ways for you to sacrifice something that you've been given, your meal plan, for example. Other privileges that you have on campus so that you're free then to pursue some shalom activity, some justice-seeking activity that God might have for you. Yes. When Baki invited us to come work for them, I worked for InterVarsity for 30 years, and when Baki invited us to work for them in their global urban leadership program, I said, I will, but I don't want to move. Because I think it's important that the director of your doctoral programs be modeling what he's teaching. So we're still in that neighborhood and still connected to all of the activities of our community and still learning how to do it, I should say. We're still learning. Yes, you had a question.
How do you deal with this of when you do go with the displacement strategy? I find, maybe I'm making it up, but I find that there's a perception that we're different, we're coming in to change you and make you like us. You know, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, we had one woman in our neighborhood, she's actually white. Within our first few weeks there, she said, "What are you white people doing here?" and she was from a different social class, and she was really talking more about our social class than our skin color. We came up with an answer for that question. It's really important, if God calls you to be displaced or to relocate, that you have an answer for that question. Our answer was, oh my gosh, we fell in love with this neighborhood. We have lots of people that we know here. We felt like we wanted to move closer to them. That was the God-honest truth. That was our answer. And that was more than sufficient for most of the folks who we were a novelty to them. Now, you know, folks are kind of used to seeing that. But nevertheless, there will always be that suspicion. We didn't come with an agenda that said, we know what you need and we're going to fix you. What was the first thing I told you today? There are no experts here, and if you think you're an expert, you need to not do anything. Don't move. Don't do anything. We came as learners, and we needed what our neighbors had. I came with this idea of having faith that was very theoretic, whereas many of my neighbors understood faith to be the thing that gets you from point A to point B in my neighborhood without getting hurt. Very tangible. Faith is not having to sleep with my landlord. you know, in order to be able to live here one more month. God, help me not have to sleep with my landlord. I believe you for that. Very tangible faith, where mine was very ethereal. I needed that understanding of faith. That's why God had me move to that neighborhood. Yes?
I'm from Ohio. I'm at Youngstown State University. My major is social work pre-law. And I picked it because I was interested in, you know, helping impoverished areas. But lately, I've developed a passion kind of for nursing. I'm thinking about changing careers. And I was just curious, do you think it's possible to be in healthcare or another field that has nothing to do with social health, you know?
Lately, you became interested in what?
Nursing.
Oh, nursing. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you a quick story. At Urbana, I don't know how many Urbanas ago, I had a student come to me and say, you know, we're halfway through this missionary conference, and I've just finally decided I'm not called to go overseas. So should I go home now? And I said, well, no, don't go home. Well, you know, what are you doing? She goes, well, I'm a science major, and I'm involved in my campus. She named the campus. I'm ashamed I can't remember the name of it. But I said, she said, well, I'm doing this major project at my campus. I said, oh, tell me about that. She goes, well, maybe you've heard about it. We're mapping the human genome. Have you guys heard about that? It's like the scientific project of our generation. Here was this young Christian woman who was a student on that project. And I said, to your knowledge, are there other Christians working on that project? She goes, I don't think so. I said, and you're asking me if you think God could use you if you don't go overseas? Oh my gosh! Invest right where you are right now. Be God's person on the Human Genome Project. That's where He wants you. That's what your passion was. You signed up for that for a reason. Oh my gosh! Be the best nurse on the planet. Really, honestly, follow that passion. What is more important than the nurture that a nurse gives to the person at a bedside? Where do the poor suffer the most right now in healthcare? It's being treated like an object. It's being treated like, well, we'll get you if you have the right card, but first you gotta sit, you know, for 5 hours in the room, and then we're gonna treat you like dirt. They need someone with God in them to sit at their side and say, you are and created in the image of God. So I'd say follow that passion is what I'd say to you. Yeah.
Matthew, I'm a nurse, and I will tell you that there is no other seen people in every walk of life.
Talk to Nurses Christian Fellowship. They're in the exhibit hall. They have reasons for everything they do, a biblical foundation, and they'll give you a vision for being that person. You'll change the face of the earth. Sister, I know you will. Yes?
I was just wondering if you think that this justice model looks the same in upper middle class suburban neighborhoods, or if it is similar, or if it is totally different.
Yeah, so let me ask this. When I ask you about sexual addiction in urban neighborhoods, what image comes to mind? It's that bookstore that's on that shady corner that prostitutes hang around and the condoms are littered in the gutter. When I ask you, do middle-class men suffer from sexual addictions? Well, the answer is of course. It's just they don't need to go down to that corner because they've got the access on the internet. They have everything they need right there. So many of the issues are the same because there are issues of sin and corruption in the human heart. The problem is those in suburban middle-class neighborhoods have props in their lives. And those props are supplied by society to maintain the status quo. So the banking system, the education system, the healthcare system, all of those things are set up for middle and upper class. The poor get crowded out. So while the needs are the same, the tools that the poor have are different than the tools that the middle class have. And so the solutions are not similar. However, here's an interesting thing. What's happening with cities now is that the poor who had, you know, they moved into the city and therefore the middle class moved out into the suburbs. Now there's reverse migration happening. And the poor are now moving out to the suburbs, to the very churches that were created to escape them. And middle-class pastors are having to figure out, how do I speak to both groups now? And it's a whole new challenge. Meanwhile, a whole new gentrifying population is moving back into central cities and having to figure out what the rules are for creating shalom there or experiencing the disparities there. So I'd say the issues are similar, but the props are so different that that's why there's, I think, special emphasis on marginalized neighborhoods and communities. Yes?
I think living for others is very hard. How can you work for justice without burning out? And how can you take care of your spirituality?
This is a very good question. There are several aspects to that answer. One aspect is something I touched on here, and that's discover how profound a theme this is in the Bible, because you have to be fully confident that this is of God. Not only has God called you to this, but will sustain you in the midst of it, to understand how others in the scriptures have dealt with these issues, to create a spirituality that's biblical that will sustain you. So the first is that biblical foundation. But then there are communal disciplines. In our neighborhood, we meet every week to pray, and we depend on each other. And if you're going to be displaced, if you're going to dismantle certain stereotypes, if you're going to discover practical strategies, it's going to be in community, and there are no successful Lone Ranger seekers of justice and shalom. So being part of a community is a really important spiritual discipline. And then I would just add to that, you know, when I talked about St. Francis and the prayer that I prayed that night, you got to know that people have gone through this kind of stuff for thousands of years. You guys, we didn't invent this stuff, right? Like, men and women of faith have suffered and died and offered their bodies to the lions. What enabled them to do that for 2,000 years? What enables the martyrs today? There are more martyrs today than at any time in history. There are dissidents in many countries today who are suffering because they're Christian and they stand for something. What enables them to do that? It's this connection to history. They feel that they're part of something and that this is a God thing. It's not their idea. They're not being noble. They're simply responding to a God who believes in justice. These are a few things. Yes?
Hi, I was wondering if you knew of any information or any directly Christian services that are focusing on the gentrification of urban neighborhoods that are like solely Christian-based and opposing those forces that are trying to change the urban landscape.
Yeah, yeah. Have a couple ideas for you. Talk to Family Consultation Services, FCS Urban Ministries in Atlanta, and read material written by Bob Lupton, L-U-P-T-O-N. He has a phrase, and those of you who have ever been to a CCDA conference, Christian Community Development Association conference, know this phrase. It's gentrification with justice. There are two classic responses to gentrification. One is to oppose it, and the other is to steer it. Because many believe that it's once market forces take over in a neighborhood, that is literally impossible to stop that momentum. And so Lupton adheres to the gentrification with justice model. It's very interesting. It's very biblical. It's worth taking a look at. But one that's more oppositional is part of the 10-point coalition in Boston, Eugene Rivers, Pastor Rivers. And then you can also talk with InterVarsity staff in Chicago, used to run the Urban Project there. Yes, in the Chicago Urban Project. You know who I'm talking about? Sandra Van Opstel. Thanks for asking the question. Sandra Van Opstel in the Chicago Urban Project. She and some of the InterVarsity staff in Chicago have been fighting gentrification in a nearby neighborhood. Those would be some options. I'm sorry? FCS Urban Ministries in Atlanta. Yeah. How are we doing? 4 minutes. Y'all want to see a little video? A little 4-minute video? Thank you, everybody, for spending time here this afternoon. Bless you all. Hi.
Jason.
Hey, Jason.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. I mean, I only made it to the very end questions part because the schedule is just nuts, and I tried to come in at the beginning, and it was packed. But, so at my school, I'm not sure if you touched on this, but at my school, I just do, like, Bible study with InterVarsity and stuff, but I really feel like God wanted me to engage with the poor there, and I go to school in Santa Cruz,
California. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I've been trying to, you know, get a group of people together, like people who feel like a similar calling, and I just don't really know like how to start, like practical things to start.
Yeah.
To start things to get going, to meet the needs of the community. I don't really know how to just get that information and what sort of practical steps I could take.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could give me any advice on that.
Yeah. So you came in just during the question and answer section?
Yeah.
Okay. A couple things I'd tell you. First thing to do is meet with your friends, but choose the subject. Investigate what the scriptures say first. And as you're doing that, become familiar with what the needs are in your city, so that simultaneously you're looking at what scripture says about poverty and about justice, and you're looking at what currently exists in your city. And it might actually mean that you disband your Bible study for a week and say, today, we're going to go out and talk to some community leaders. We're going to go visit this ministry. And our question to that ministry is, tell us who you know that's doing justice ministry in our city. After a few weeks of doing that, you've got some scripture and you've got these practical interactions with what already exists. Because it's important you get a real vision of what's already there. You don't have to invent anything new.
My